The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
I think it's Monday. It is. And we have a really neat program tonight for you. Well, some of it's not so neat. It's pretty ghastly. But the first hour, at least, we're going to do a little time travel, have a little fun. Don Jeffries is back, as he is every Monday. And Don is here every Monday because John Barber told me to put him on. And I did. And he far exceeded my hopes and expectations. And, well, let's first say hello to Don. Hello, Donald.
Hey, Jeff. How you doing?
I'm still here. Thank you. Now, we have a special guest, a friend of ours, and he is literally a legend in his own time and then some. He's a remarkable man.
In his own mind.
I don't want to go there. No. Because I happen to agree, and so does Don, and so do millions of people listening. You are extraordinary, and I mean that with all respect and sincerity. You're just a remarkable human being, and we're all the better for having you with us. So, welcome!
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. You know, and I'll tell you something. Woody Allen made a movie in Paris called Coup de Chance, which means stroke of luck. And he says in his book, he said that the most important thing that led to his good fortune was good luck. And you know what? I'm sort of inclined to believe that, because being on tonight not only is a stroke of good luck, but it's absolute serendipity, which I believe in because it's happened to me all my professional life and all my personal life. Now, when I was with you, oh, by the way, let me start off by saying this. Since you have two guests tonight, Jeff.
Yes.
I don't want you to be saying, let's start with age over beauty, okay?
Because I didn't say that.
No, well, start that way, because in that way, if that's the case, I'd be speaking twice.
I'm still okay. Trying to figure out who Serendipity is. I've never heard of her before.
Okay.
Who is Serendipity?
Very cute. Anyway,
all right.
The last time I was here, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about television, because that's where I was born and raised, television. And that's how you were raised, watching television. Donald was raised. America was shaped by television, and you never got around to it. So I said to you, you know, maybe I'd love to come back with one of my very best and dearest and most talented friends, Donald, on a Monday, but I wouldn't want to take up too much of his time just to talk about TV. But a lot more things have happened that only happened today that bring this, it's serendipity. Okay, now, most people, when they're starting a new enterprise like this conversation is tonight, they like to start with a little prayer, okay? But not me, because you know very well that I have no more interest in prayer, and I want to go there because in the last few shows that I've done, Don't You Know It, I've become a bit of a poet. So I would like to start.
You have. Quatrains, okay. Limericks, you name it. They're all there.
And so this is sort of a dedication to Donald because he has written by far the second greatest book ever about money, which is called Survival of the Richest. It's the second greatest to Karl Marx, Das Kapital.
Wow.
I mean, that's how good it is. So in thinking about his book and money, it's just this, okay? A fool with his money will find out it very soon will part. A fool will also find out the same could happen with his heart. Sometimes now I prefer the dark of night, because in my dreams I see love and peace as clear as day. But when the sun comes up and the day is here, in the light of reality, they just drift away. Anyway, so...
Well, now, that just came to you in a serendipitous fashion, did it?
That's
that wonderful
right,
little...
And it pours out. It's just horrible. But in any event, the reason I am thrilled to be here with Donald, because, you know, it was 5 and 6 years ago, for 2 years, I used to do an hour show called John Barber's World. And the last 15 minutes, my guest was Joe Satilli, who has this terrific newsletter called News Vandal with a huge subscription rate. And the two most intelligent and informed and knowledgeable people in the world about news is your guest tonight, Donald Jeffries, and Joe Satilli. Now, I've known and been a close friend of both of them ever since I don't know when. But for the first time in 8 years, in Joe Satilli's News Vandal, he published something of mine. And you know what it was? It was the third documentary called John Barber's and William Shakespeare's Last Word on the murder of JFK. And now thousands of more people will see it thanks to that. But that's not the... I mean, I'm bowled over by it. But what really bowled me over was... I guess it was a couple of weeks ago, New York Magazine called Intelligencer or something, did like 14 pages on a guy named Jefferson Morley, who was an ordinary researcher, but he goes through courts a lot to get some of the CIA files and the Garrison files, which he's been very unsuccessful at doing. And they lauded him enormously. And Donald wrote them a letter. And Donald, I must tell you, when I read it to Sarita, she started crying. And I said, why on earth are you crying? She said, honey, you know, nobody really comes to your aid about the films that you do with Mr. Garrison, except Jeff Frantz and George Knapp and Leno Sanek and a couple of others. But they never write letters for you. Please read it to me again. So Donald and Jeff, if you don't mind, would you mind if Donald read that letter because Sarita wants to hear it read?
No, of course. That's no problem. But and for all of you out there who are listening, know that at Rents.com, we have a columnist section on the left, and John Barber has his own columnist section. And we have updated things. I even have the program up there we did on the 23rd of November with Don. And we talked about the new film, and it's all there, too. So... with your friends helping you, this film is certainly being looked at, and that's critically important. It's a very, very wonderful achievement, and you've been at this for a long time. So, well done.
Thank you. Anyway.
Go ahead, Don.
Okay, let's do that. I have it queued up here. It says, I read your magazine's November 9th article on the JFK assassination archive with interest. Frankly, there was nothing new whatsoever in the piece. Most of the information had been fully exposed and analyzed by the early group of Warren Report critics like Mark Lane and Harold Weisberg. Jefferson Morley is fine for a mainstream reporter, but he's hardly the expert on the case. I have been researching the JFK assassination since I was a teenage volunteer with Mark Lane's Citizens Committee of Inquiry in the mid-1970s. The purported experts quoted by writer Scott Sayare are all lukewarm neo-doubters of the official story. I'm speaking of Anthony Summers, Paul Hoke, and Robert Blakey, whose HSCA investigation supported every ridiculous tenet of the official story, including the single bullet theory. Morley himself is probably in this category as well. When Jim Garrison finally gave his first interview after the Clay Shaw trial, it wasn't the CBS News, or Robert Blakey, or even Oliver Stone. It certainly wasn't the Jefferson Morley. Garrison chose to have John Barber, the creator and host of the number one television show, Real People, tell his story. Barber went on to produce the two most outstanding documentaries ever done on this subject, the JFK assassination of the Garrison tapes in 1992, and the American media and the second assassination of John F. Kennedy in 2017. You really ought to talk to John Barber. Now, that would be a great story for you. No one has analyzed Garrison's voluminous files more thoroughly than he has. He also might regale you with stories of a Hollywood that is long gone, including his stint as Frank Sinatra's personal writer for several years. There are no secrets needed here. Intrepid souls like Lane and Garrison and Stone and John Barber have proven beyond the shadow of any doubt that whoever killed JFK wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald. Why is the American media still pretending otherwise? Thanks.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I never mentioned that word, but thank you, thank you, thank you so much. And since you mentioned me with Sinatra, and so that sort of might lead sort of to TV, because Jeff sent me something today about Joan Rivers, whom I knew really, really well. So, Jeff, you want to talk a little bit about that, which may lead me into some really terrific stuff I want to talk about when it comes to television?
Would you like me to talk about what I sent you in print form or that video?
No, I just want you to ad lib what it is that you were talking about when it comes to Joan Rivers, or do you want me, or do we want...
Oh, okay, I got it. No, I got it. Okay. First of all, there's a very good story up at the website, and it has to do with Joan Rivers, and it raises a very serious question. Did Joan Rivers really die in that medical clinic, or did she not? Was her death faked so she could retire from the grind of performing at nearly 80 years of age, and live a happy and peaceful life and enjoy things with Melissa, her daughter, and so forth? And this fellow who put this video together is stunned me, because some of the live sound in the video is talking about events that occurred 6 months or later after Joan allegedly died. And there's Joan in the video. Her hair is short. She doesn't have all her makeup on. She's standing out of the camera line of sight off to the right. And she's with Clive Davis, I guess a friend of hers. I think it's Clive Davis. Anyhow, at the end, she walks over to Clive, and they walk toward the camera, one of them, down toward the car. They're going to leave. It's Joan. And you can hear her talk. It's Joan. John, you knew her. You know her voice. You can't mistake that voice. So anyhow, I think there's a really strong case to be made that Joan Rivers is still alive. And I certainly hope so. Now, well, I knew Joan... Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Finish it. Finish
well,
it.
Well, I was the news director and anchorman at KTNV Las Vegas for 3 years. And I worked there, and I was driven out after 3 years by the heat. It was just too much. 112 at midnight? It's too much. So I did get to know a lot of really nice people there, very interesting people. And I remember one day I got a call in the studio, and some woman is there. She says, Joan Rivers would like to speak with you. Oh, what? All right. So I talked to her, and she invited me over to her residential suite at the top of the MGM, where all the big entertainers would stay for their residency, whether it's, you know, a month or 2 months. It was their home. And I went over, and Joan and I became very good friends. This is like late at night. I'd go over after the late news, 11:30 or whatever. And She was just a very sweet, kind person with an absolutely brilliant wit, as you know. Her own brand of comedy, her own way of looking at life and people, and her cadence and her delivery were just as good as they could possibly be. I've never heard anything like it. Well, one time she called and she said, "Jeff, you've got to do me a favor. I don't think I'm telling things out of school here. This is just what happened. You got to do me a favor." I said, "What is it? What do you need?" "Well, I've got to go to this private party in Las Vegas in town, and I hate going because Edgar's visiting, and he doesn't want anything to do with these things. So I need you to come with me to the party and try to keep Edgar company. Keep him happy." You're laughing. We'll find out more about that. So I went over there, and we piled into her car, and Edgar's there, and Joan's there, and the driver's there, and I'm anyhow. We went to the party, and I did my best to engage Edgar. But as John knows, Edgar wasn't actually a great conversationalist. He was kind of quiet, and he didn't react much. And I had the feeling he was wondering, "Well, who's this guy, and how does he know my wife?" And it was funny. Anyhow, we went to the party, and it was a kind of a weird Las Vegas party. I think it was around Halloween. And the house, this private home, was big, and it was all decorated with strange, and I would say now, at least quasi-satanic symbolism. Lots of lit candles. It was weird. Lots of gays that were there. Joan had a tremendous gay following, and I think this party was put on by some of her big fans, and she had to go. So anyway, I spent the evening doing that with Edgar, and very shortly thereafter, Edgar checked out. He committed suicide, as John knows. What? And the interesting part of this is that during that time, John was also deeply engaged with both Edgar and Joan in a business issue, which I'll let John describe as well. So, well, she was a real sweet, sweet lady, and I really had a lot of fun with her. She was a great gal. Anyhow,
when she went into the clinic and she died, I do not think that she was trying to figure a way out of retiring, because they've said that of Elvis Presley and John Kennedy.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. The lady I knew just lived to perform. And on television, she had one of the most successful shows. It was like the Fashion Police. It was monumentally hilarious.
I bet. Yeah.
Okay. But she was not a very good talk show host, you know. She couldn't get back on Carson's show once she started her own show. So her show was dying. So she and Edgar called me and asked me if I would produce the show. So I went to their house to meet with them. And right. I said to her, "Joan, you know, I don't want to produce your show. But what I would love to do, even though I would love to have my own talk show, and that's why I got into television, is to have it because of Jack Parr." And she cheered because she loved Jack Parr too. I said, "And I don't want to be Ed McMahon, but I would be thrilled to be your sidekick." And she applauded, but Edgar stood up and said, "What a great idea." And she said, "Why are you saying that, Johnny?" And I said, "Because look at how goyish I am and how Jewish you are, okay?" I said, "That's perfect."
And salt and pepper.
Yes, and Edgar said, "Would you do it, honey? I'll let you know." And then, of course, Edgar committed suicide at the thought of my becoming part of the show. Anyway, so I called Joan and offered her condolences. She rattled off the funniest death jokes I ever heard.
That's how she handled stress and pressure like that.
I said, "Don't do that to me." She said, "You know, this is sitting shiva, goddammit. And Jews make jokes about the dying. And I've got a lot to say that's funny about this guy that just talked to himself." She didn't call him by name. Now, I thought she was off, as I even thought Bill Hicks was off. Because she called President Obama a fag on the air and called Michelle a trans and said, look at her crotch. She's got balls. I mean, and she said it publicly. So I was concerned. I do not think she offed herself. And as for missing her, oh, my God. We need her, and we need Bill Hicks, and we need George Carlin. There's nobody like that right now. But then what happened?
I'd even take Rodney Dangerfield. Come on.
Oh, God, yes. Yes, and there are magnificent stories about me and Rodney in my book. But aside from that, when she heard I was doing my second album, I met a man I didn't like about my movie reviews. She called me, and she said, put me on the list. I said, what list? She said, I'm going to be writing some of the stuff on the back of your comedy album. And she wrote some of the greatest stuff on the back of the album. So now this sort of brings me to TV. And what I would like to do is I would like to talk to about that, if you don't mind. I made a couple of notes here. And do you mind if I begin?
No, of course not.
Please. Okay. In the 60s and 70s, while I was struggling.
Oh, John, may I say, John, before you go, let me say something about this video that's put together claiming that she didn't die. It looks like Joan with very short hair and no makeup, and she's standing out of the way, and then she sort of comes back and walks to the car.
Yes, but let me tell you something, Jeff.
Tell me what your thoughts are about that.
Oh, hold it. Let me tell you something. I can't tell you publicly what happened. It's a private issue. But it was a woman who claimed she was a billionaire who was trying to befriend me. And she sent me pictures of her home and her children and stuff like that. My son said, what are you talking about? He said, give me your phone number, give me your address, and I'll get it cleared up. Now, my son is the executive producer of Criminal Minds. And they're like the Secret Service. They can find out shit in 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. He found out she's a fraud in 5 minutes. He said, Dad, you should know that now we can create anything on television and make it look real. You're going to have to do it. Okay,
I know. Digital world. I know.
Yes. I wouldn't even want to look at it because I like the memories that I have of Joan. And so I'll live with that. But in any event, I wanted to talk about television.
Hey, let me say one other thing. I don't know who would put this together, why it might have been put together. It is a very interesting little video, 6 minute long, and stranger things have happened in life. That's all I can tell you. I do believe she did pass away in the clinic. That's obviously under a cloud as well for reasons we've discussed in the past. But in any case, I never saw any other entertainer demolish an audience like I saw Joan Rivers do at the MGM.
But you know, the reason why I think there's so many theories about Joan Rivers before this came up, the theories that was that Joan was knocked off because of the fact her last time she was recorded on tape, that's when she called Obama gay and Michelle, a tranny. And that's what really started the big mic rumors when she said that. And then she dies, you know, very oddly under what we were told was, you know, relatively routine plastic surgery. And how many, you know, God, she probably had 800 plastic surgery. That was part of her act joking about it, right?
Yes.
So that's, I think, what makes people speculate so much is because what she said the last time she was on camera.
It's like Bill Hicks couldn't make it in this country. He was a rock star like the Beatles in England. And there's a YouTube with him at Oxford University. And he's saying that if we were going to repay the Iraqis for the horrors we committed on them, we should just cut off Bush's head and send it to them. And they cheered, okay? Shortly after that, he gets pancreatic cancer and dies. Okay, so now I want to get to this business about television because I sent something to Donald that he may have heard of, but it's the greatest thing ever in the history of television. So I just made a couple of notes. In the 60s and 70s, while I was struggling to get a foothold in television, I was also inspired to keep at it because we're almost a dozen shows a week, either on network television or PBS. I had to stop everything to watch. On network television, it was All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Golden Girls, Columbo, MASH, and a few others in reruns of I Love Lucy and Sid Caesar. For talk shows, Merv Griffin, Johnny Carson, and for serious talk, David Susskind. On PBS, I, Claudius, the greatest drama ever written for television, and Fawlty Towers, one of the greatest comedies, both from the BBC. And I just sent the I, Claudius, all the films to Donald as a gift. Okay. From PBS itself, Carl Sagan on Science and the Universe. Of course, I could mention a couple of others more recent, like Victoria and Downton Abbey, which were close to must watch, but nothing like those above. I do not mention real people because my modesty as a creator, co-host, and co-producer prevent me from doing so, even though for the 3 years I was there doing that show, I never missed it. Which brings me to the purpose of this post. In spite of all my searching, the only show now I stop everything to watch, even if a Los Angeles Kings hockey game is going on, is Doc Martin, again from Britain, on PBS Thursday nights at 9 o'clock here in Las Vegas. It is a magnificent, engaging, small-town people show. The lead character is a brilliant curmudgeon doctor who loves his job but hates small talk and has never heard of a bedside manner. So my question is there anyone else out there that enjoys it as much as I do? Let me know, or let me know if you found another great show that you stopped everything to watch. I was absolutely flooded with hundreds of letters of people saying, geez, John, thank God you're a critic again, because they love that show. Now, Donald, do you have a show that you like to watch?
For me? Well, right now, I used to love South Park, but I think it's really kind of jumped the shark the last couple of years. But It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, I think, is a very funny comedy. It's still on, I think, but again, it's past its prime. But other than that, I don't watch any new shows, really.
And in your case, Jeff, when you were growing up, you had to be a fan of television to be as smart as you are. I know you gave it up because it got so bad. But what were you watching when you were younger? Are you still there?
I'm here. No, go ahead. I thought you were going.
When I was younger, I was a TV junkie.
I was talking to Jeff.
When
he was younger, yeah. Jeff, you, because you're so good at what you do. And you have such a knowledge of show business, you gave up television because it really, it's just god-awful. What shows did you watch when you were younger and a news director?
I was a big fan of Steve Allen when I was real little, who doesn't get any mention at all. And he was a real pioneer. Ernie Kovacs, who you knew, I mean, you're the Ernie Kovacs guy, like you are the Jim Garrison guy. Kovacs, Steve Allen. There were a number of them. I'd have to think about it. But TV, when we used to have the black and white set, and then it morphed into color and all that, and it was just a whole new dawn of. Even when I was a child, I'd notice people watching television. They were not there anymore in the room. They were gone. They were mesmerized by it.
Yeah,
they were encoded.
You'd see shots of people out in the street, and there's a television set in a store window, and 25 people are staring at it. Now, another reason, tonight is serendipity. About 5 months ago, did anybody watch the Golden Globes last night. I did not. I don't watch those things anymore.
No, I don't watch TV, John.
I think my wife did. She still watches those shows. I don't know how, but I didn't.
Okay. Then you must know via your wife that Robert Downey Jr. won a Golden Globe, right?
I think I heard that, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And the movie that won was Oppenheimer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, get this. 5 months ago in August, when it first came out, I had dozens and dozens of people calling me and emailing me and asking me if I would review it the same way I reviewed Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which was the only movie I ever absolutely loathed because it destroyed the truth of the horrible slaughter of what happened in the Tate House. I absolutely loathed that movie, the only one in my life. And I said to them, well, listen, I don't know that I'm going to loathe it. I don't want to loathe anything. I hope I enjoy it. And they said, well, listen, you're into history. You used to be a critic. Do us a favor. Would you review it? So I reviewed it, and somebody sent me the review today because it won the Golden Globe, and it won Robert Downey Jr. the Golden Globe, which I predicted in August. Would you mind if I read that review to you?
No. Go ahead. Now, we'll talk about Carol Hennig at some point, too. And your reviews. We need to do that. Mention that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, this is not in Carol's wonderful book because I didn't even want to go. You know, after I put
this is a new one. I get it. No, I get it.
Yeah. Okay. So here it is. Here it is. Oppenheimer is the story of the man and scientist who was known as the father of the atom bomb, one of which may or may not have been necessary to end the war with Japan. The second one dropped on Nagasaki was totally unnecessary, according to almost every sane human on the planet, but not to America's inhuman military-industrial complex. But before starting this three-hour film, they should have dropped the third one on the orchestra pit. There are almost no moments in this movie, at least 20 seconds long, so that we can hear the dialogue, a lot of which is convoluted physics anyway, where we are not distracted by the band. When I go to a film or pick up a book, fiction or nonfiction, or watch a television series, I say simply, just tell me a story. As an abandoned six-year-old, I was saved by listening to or watching endless stories. With a passion, I learned early that stories have a beginning and a middle and an end. And the best of them sometimes have flashbacks, which add dimension and texture to both the characters and the story. With books, it was the excitement of opening the cover. With films, it was anxiously waiting to get past who was making it and who was in it. I just wanted it to begin. Oppenheimer happily began immediately, but got unhappy real quick. We see a restless college student, maybe having nightmares of universes or galaxies or planets bursting into flame. Then we think, this is Oppenheimer. He's just seeing in his mind as a young physicist what he is thinking about, or maybe the explosions we're going to see later over Hiroshima. And the explosions were not as loud as the orchestra. I was hoping for my first flashback so I could see him as a young boy with his brother, maybe playing or going to synagogue or chatting around the table with his mother and father, talking about corned beef cabbages, or maybe seeing how glib and attractive he was to girls, since later he's accused by his detractors in the FBI as being a womanizer. None of that happens. And as the film continues and the band plays on, I discovered there's no middle. And since the director and the writer did not give us any flashbacks to inform us as to how Robert was shaped into this genius, they gave us a bunch of very distracting fast forwards. Only someone deeply, deeply knowledgeable about World War II and the time of the blacklisting and the commie-hating Bill of Rights and Constitution-destroying insanity in America that we are all more sadly to heir to today would understand what was going on. We are now in the middle of the film and discover we are just spectators at the building of the bomb, but in no way emotionally attached to its builder. The one person who seems totally together is the general who hires Oppenheimer to head up and build Los Alamos and the bomb in 1942. This general is played brilliantly by Matt Damon. Then we get to the end, and for some reason do not see what the bombs did to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Cleansed. But It's at the end that I felt the story began. And the story was a mini version of an Othello. His Iago is an equally beyond brilliant Robert Downey Jr., who plays Strauss, who'd do anything to become part of Truman's cabinet. And in order to get there, he has to totally destroy Oppenheimer, now the world's most famous scientist, even more popular than Einstein. And he has to destroy him with an avalanche of lies and a coterie of lying lawyers, which we all know can be found anywhere, especially in the Senate. It would have been a much, much better ending had we seen early a little bit of Strauss's plotting and plannings against Oppenheimer. Like Iago, and personally I would have loved to have learned more about what was shaping, who was shaping Robert at 6 years of age, we do not see the credits till the end, when half of the people had already left. For a moment, I thought they were going to list the conductor and the band members first. As for Robert Downey Jr., the worst thing about his name is the junior. As one of the greatest, or if not the greatest, most natural film actor in the world, he is junior to no one.
I agree. You haven't lost a thing. This could have flashed back to the late 60s.
Oh,
that's a great review. I haven't seen the movie. Yeah. I just don't see movies. They should consult you before they make these damn films.
Well, nobody's interested in me. The one guy who consulted me was Robert Evans over a movie named Black Tuesday. It's a funny story in my book. Carol just loved the story. Anyway, because he had read that I had saved Martin Scorsese's film, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, from being destroyed and not distributed by Warner Brothers. And he was, quite honestly, the one who made and saved The Godfather. That's known very little. He was the one that defended the hiring of Al Pacino. And, of course, the first Godfather was offered to Laurence Olivier. And he said, no, we're going to get Marlon Brando. And even though all the actors only got $30,000 for it, he was the one that held it together, because the financiers at Paramount in New York wanted him to get almost rid of everybody, including Coppola. And it is one of the most perfect movies ever made, because I've watched it about 12 times. And if I'm flipping around the set and I see a scene, I can't stop watching it again. Anyway, he called me, and had a movie called Black Tuesday. And Robert Dern and Robert Shaw were in the movie. And it was about a terrorist attack on the Super Bowl, which comes up in 3 or 4 days here in Las Vegas. Anyway, do you want to hear the rest of this story?
Yeah.
No, I want to hear something from Donald. So let me tell it very quickly. Anyway, and I must tell you, one of the really upsetting things about it, his 8-year-old son was in the office to begin with, and the 8-year-old son was ordering the chauffeur around. And Robert was trying to get the chauffeur to get the kid in the car to get out of Paramount and down to Disneyland. And the kid is 8, and he's swearing at the chauffeur, for God's sake. It was just disgusting. I don't know why the father didn't get up and punch the kid in the face. So I was in a very uncomfortable surrounding. And he said, okay, would you look at my Black Tuesday? And I said, yeah, I'll look at it, but I don't want to talk about it afterwards. He said, well, listen, I've set up a private screening, and there's somebody there to serve you drinks and stuff. He sets up a private screen. There's the most gorgeous waitress there with champagne, which I don't drink, and then Cabernet sandwiches and stuff like that. And I watched the movie. So in any event, he calls me back in. He's all excited. And he says, well, and I said, well, what? He says, what do you think? I said, I think I'm going to wait until I get back to NBC and it comes out in a month or two, and then you'll hear what I think. He's, no, no, goddammit, you got to do it right now. Please, I need your advice. I said, but you may not follow it. He said, listen, what you did for Scorsese, you might be able to do for me. I said, well, you must be bothered by something in the film. He said, no, it's a masterpiece. I said, well, you don't need me. He said, John, please, please. I said, well, I'll tell you, there's one scene that doesn't work. And he said, what scene is that? And I said, well, it's a Super Bowl in New Orleans. Okay, so it's a Bruce Dern that's a bad guy, and the Bruce Dern is down by the truck on the ground, and he has a device to set off the bomb that could kill 50,000 people in the stadium. And Robert Shaw's in the last row of this stadium, okay? He's the good guy, and he knows Bruce Dern is down there. And so he starts jumping over everybody to run down there. And he said, what's wrong with that? I said, he has a phone in his pocket. He said, what? Whoops. I said, everybody knows he has a phone in his pocket. So you either have to take out the phone somehow, because we've already seen him using it. He said, I'm not doing that. I said, well, listen, people are going to start to giggle and say, why doesn't he use the phone? He says, it cost me $50,000 to shoot that scene, and it's staying at it as it is. And so
that's funny.
I reviewed. That was my review when I got on the air, was my whole experience. Oh, God, everybody in town hated me, except probably a few thousand other actors who absolutely loved me. So anyway, that's
funny,
the last
stuff. Funny stuff. All right, may I have 60 seconds here? We have to do this. We have to just a
more,
little. You'll like
more
this. This is just a random clip from the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. All right, we just have to pay it just a little tribute. And Cycle 3 was a canned dog food, in case any of you don't remember.
Oh, oh my God.
Because a woman has to have good looks, unless she's very rich. If you're rich, it doesn't matter. Christina Onassis, who's a dear friend of mine.
Yes.
Is she here?
Close, is she?
That's a... Look for a woman eating Cycle 3. Very well, but she's just... Oh, here we go. No, is she pretty? Oh, grow up, America. I am so bored with...
Well, she's not... She's not a beauty.
Oh, that's putting it nicely. She has shoes that have holes for thumbs. There's enough.
But she's rich.
But she's rich. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
First time I met her, I...
All right. That's a little, just a little sample.
Oh, my Pull God. Up. I wish you could have kept playing that shit. And her jokes about Liz Taylor. I mean, yeah. I one classic one. She'd stick something in the microwave, yell at it. Hurry, hurry.
God. These are giants, and they're all gone. And we have no replacements for them.
Oh, my God.
No.
Yeah. Oh, my God. And I must tell you, oh, yeah, and, you know, oh, God, one who was so dear to me was Shecky Green.
Shecky, oh, yeah.
Yes, oh, my God.
He just passed. Yeah.
Yes, he just passed away. My God, nobody performed on stage like he did. I mean, there were all bunches who were funny, but he exploded physically on the stage. He would fall down and he would roll over. And he was one of my biggest fans when I started. He thought for sure. He told, I was sitting in the audience at the Sahara one night and he happened to see me there. He said, "Hey, folks, do you want to see the next Jack Parr?" And he points at me. He said, "Johnny, get up here, get up here." Now, you know me, I'm very, very quiet when I talk. You know, I just try to write good jokes. And I did 4 or 5 minutes. And he was my biggest fan. And the audience was cheering me because he led them on.
How nice. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Class act.
And the last time I saw him, there was a club here in town called South Point. And it was 5 years ago, and my wife went down to see him and spent an hour with him in his dressing room afterwards. So, no. Oh, my God.
And
oh.
Let's not forget, we have a few minutes left. We have to pay a little tribute to another brilliant audience-demolishing wit, Red Fox, your friend.
Oh, my God. There's so much I love about Red. I mean, when he heard I was interested in Garrison, said what a hero he was. And he said, "Heroes ain't born. They're cornered." I mean, God. And so, and he ad-libbed the funniest line I've ever heard, which I could never get away. We could never get away with now, but it's in one of my YouTube, because when I got my first talk show, I booked Red. Because I knew he was witty and clean. The first appearance on television, though, was Hugh Downs put him on the Today Show where they just talked. He didn't perform. But to actually perform, he got to perform on my show. And he walked out and he was wearing these knickers that the Scotch wear when they play golf. You know, these pants.
Yeah.
So we watch out there. He's got his cigarette in his mouth, you know, and he's just standing there looking at the audience, not saying, and they start giggling. Oh, and he says, "Oh, I was just down south. And I saw these people yelling, 'Knickers, Knickers,' so I went out and bought me a pair." Oh, my God, the audience screamed. So when he sits down and we start talking about, he had this great routine about why he didn't get involved with Black Power or White Power. And Jack Carter was a guest, and then the crying comedian was a guest, because I wanted to do a show with comedians who were established and then introduce Red. And so I said to Red, "Well, how do you feel about White Power and Black Power?" He said, "I don't care about Black Power, White Power. I only cares about Green Power." I said, "What?" He said, "You got the green, you can buy the places where the blacks and whites hold their meetings." So the audience laughs and applauds. Now, I thought I was going to embarrass him, and I thought I would ruin his act. But I am so impulsive, and lines come to me from nowhere. I don't know where they come from, and I just blurted out, "Red, why do you think money's colored green?" He didn't miss a beat, and he said, "That's because Jews pick it before it gets ripe."
Oh, my. That is a truly classic line.
Oh, my God. We couldn't continue the show for 20 minutes.
No.
You watch that video. Jack Carter keeps getting up out of his seat, pulling out a $20 bill, said, "Jews pick this, all right." I mean, it was. And there's no more television like that. There are no more performers like that.
No, they're gone. No replacements for them.
None whatsoever. And I think a thing that if you want to see Bob Hope at his most human, you have to go to my site, because he gave up doing a Christmas show for the soldiers to come to Channel 13, KCOP, to do a half hour live with me. And he told all of his friends it was the best interview he ever had in his life. And he started off by saying he wanted to be a dancer. And that's what he did. He had no intentions of ever becoming a comic. It was all accidental. And the magnificent thing about it, he remembered every joke. When the stars didn't show up one night and the owners asked him to go out and say something, he didn't know what to say. And he said something stupid like, you know, about this farmer he met in Scotland who wanted to get married, but he had to get married in the barnyard so the chicken could eat the rice. I mean, it just poured this stuff out. And then also, this is also not planned. We're live and a phone call comes in and we expect a viewer, a fan, and it's Bing Crosby. And the wonderful thing is that Crosby could remember the first girl he dated, and Bob Hope could remember the first sponsor. And the exchange between them is as good as anything that was in the road shows. So, but again, before we part, Donald, I cannot thank you enough. You know, it's not just, you know, me being sort of happy, feeling like somebody has come to the aid of Don Quixote. Give me a new horse and a lance and better things to tilt at than windmills. Sarita is so thankful to you. So that's why I asked you if you had the I, Claudius. If you start watching that, you will stop hosting for a while and writing for a while. It is by far the most riveting drama ever written. And here I am. We are not on camera, and I'm waving my arms all over the place. You will love it. I, Claudius.
Well, we'll expect your review, Don, when you're done with it.
I will have to. You built it up now. My expectations are really high. No, I wish I had the power and the standing to be able to really defend you, because you should be the dean of the JFK assassination research community. You should be at the center of all their ridiculous get-togethers and forums, and the ones they never invite me to. You should be the ones doing that right there. And just as you should have people like Jane Pauley and people on TV. They should have all interviewed when your book came out. So, how can I not defend you? I just wish I could really defend you instead of just being,
well,
I am, you know.
You know, there's a wonderful Matt Monroe song about how he sings it. It's about how he was once a famous singer. And I feel like that. Listen, do you know I had the most successful show in American television? We were watched more than any other show. I was becoming a major star, and George Slaughter ended it. But it didn't bother me because I went on to do the Garrison stuff, which is a whole lot more important. And now I get to do Jeff's show. I get to, you know, tell jokes and tell stories and stuff like that's good enough for me. I am one of the happiest, most contented people I know.
Doesn't get any nicer than that, John, the way you phrased that and stated it. That's enjoying life.
Yeah.
And what a life you have led and continue to. You've not missed a beat. You're right on top of your game. It's amazing.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me on Donald's Monday Night.
It's wonderful. Always been great being with you, John. You're the most rewarding friendship I've ever had.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Jeff, bless you.
Thank you, Johnny. Give Sarita a hug. Thank you. You be well.
She'll hear this. I got to give her two boxes of Kleenex.
All right. You guys take care.
Okay. I'll see you on the 26th.
Okay, John. Thanks.
That's right.
Don, that was really very special. And thanks for the airtime. And you just can't get enough out of John Barber. We want to memorialize every single moment we have with that guy.
That's right. That's exactly right.
All right. You be well. I'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Thank you.
Good night, Don. All right. We will be back with more after this.